This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM.
Arnie Sherman, a good Sunday morning to you and happy 2025.
Happy 2025 to you, Scott. It's an exciting year. I'm looking forward to all of the unknowns. To me, in some ways, are very exciting. And today's show with Robert Tino Sonora, our go-to, economics professor, to talk about, the new Trump administration and Project 2025 and what's this all going to mean for tariffs and tax cuts and making housing more affordable and inflation and all those kinds of things, which are really important issues for our listeners to understand what's happening and how to understand this environment we're swirling in. And maybe most importantly, how to separate the campaign rhetoric, which, says we're going to put a chicken in every pot for every American, from what's really practically possible.
Yeah, let's policy.
Tino's good at demystifying all of this.
He sure is. He's our return guest will be Tino Sonora, professor of finance, the School of Business with the University of Montana. Back with Tino after these words. All right, Arnie, we are back with Robert Tino Sonora, who is the professor of finance at the College of Business with the University of Montana.
Tino, it's good to have you back on the show. As Scott knows and some of our listeners know, Tino has been a semi-regular guest here talking about a variety of issues, both Montana economics, what's happening globally and how it affects Montana. We haven't had him on, though, when there's a change in administration in Washington, D.C., and as dramatic a change as we're going to see. And so we want to talk about all of those things in as non-political way as possible. We want to try to look at the facts and try to kind of, assess what all of this means or what's been rhetorical and what's real and what's not real. And then also, what the effects might be on Montana. So if that's good with you, Tina, this is the way we want to move forward.
Well, first and foremost, great to see you guys. It's been a while. I don't know, maybe a year and a half since I've been on. So thanks for inviting me back and look forward to having a conversation. And as you say, I think separating the wheat from the chaff is going to be the interesting thing. It's going to be sort of the parlor game for the next year or so, is figuring out how much is rhetoric and how much is actually policy that's going to be implemented. And so, it's going to be an interesting year. And I think, over the course of this year, certainly the first few months of the new administration, maybe we'll start getting a few facts and basically understand what policies the administration is going to try and get through and what policies is really just, a bunch of just noise.
Yeah, one of the things I think is important, and I think a lot of our listeners understand this, when you go through a lengthening presidential campaign, they almost run 4 years now. As soon as you're elected, you're running for the next time. There's a lot of rhetoric that you throw out there about what you want to do and, what you're planning to do and what the country needs. But there is a huge difference between saying we're going to have 99 cent eggs or $1.87 gas and making that happen from the White House, so to speak, or from Congress even. There's so many factors that affect a gas price or 99 cents eggs. I'm spending a little time in Las Vegas so I can play golf during the winter. And I walked into the local Smith grocery store, which is a subsidiary of Kroger, and there's no eggs in the store. They haven't had eggs for a week. So I guess they're free eggs because there aren't any. You can't pay anything for them because there are none in the store. So I think some of it, we all know this campaign rhetoric and you say what you want to say to appeal to, voters or create a vision. And then, some of those things can be done and some of those things can't be done. But let me put this in just one bigger perspective. What we have here is that most times a campaign that's running or a political party kind of puts out their own plan, economic plan. And this time, the Heritage Foundation, with a $22 million budget, created Project 2025, which had a lot of economic weight to it. And a lot of what was in Project 2025, at some point with a wink and a nod, Trump said he had nothing to do with it, but a lot of his people did. And then he said he knew about it. And then once he was elected, he said he's going to do a lot of the things that are in 2025. And it calls for all sorts of things from, tax cuts or extending tax cuts to imposing tariffs as high as 60%. And I think most people don't really understand. And the first thing I'm going to ask you about is tariffs and try to explain them to the average listener out there, creating more jobs. And then most recently, some of the fringe part of that plan is taking over Greenland or taking over the Panama Canal, which is for economic reasons. They don't like how much it costs to put ships through the canal. And we had control of it at one time before, and now we don't have control over it, and trying to reduce inflation, although inflation's pretty low. So let me just say, in general, that's the kind of mix of things that are going on now, trying to sort, as you mentioned, what's real and what's not real and what's attainable and what's not attainable. What's your overall take on where we're at now and what the pathway forward is?
Well, I think that's the $64 trillion question, I think, probably. What path are we on? Well, again, it depends on what policies actually become implemented and what policies end up just being sort of a wish list. I know that like the Tax Foundation put together sort of a fiscal analysis of both Trump and Harris's plan, but the Trump administration really didn't put down anything on paper with respect to what their economic plan was. And so I know that the Tax Foundation was, which is a fairly conservative institution, basically was just have to like listen to all of his speeches and try and figure out exactly what was the plan, And so when they wrote up their sort of analysis of the Harris versus the Trump administration's candidates at that time, what the impacts of their policies were going to be on deficits and debt was, basically it was like cobbled together. Well, we're not going to tax, tips. Okay, so we got to throw that in there. Oh, we're going to reduce, taxes on, shellfish. Okay, I got to write that down. And so it's kind of from that perspective, it made for a very, very difficult sorting out of what is actually going to be happening. And like I said earlier, when there is a lot of noise, and we're just waiting for that signal to come through because, Congress does have to get involved with this. We got a very thin margin in Congress. Some of the GOP Congress people are not, maybe not be as lock, stock, and barrel with Trump. And that might actually kind of stall some of his initiatives. Again, some of this could be heavily rhetoric just to try to get everybody's kind of ex ante, get everybody in line with what it is that Trump is trying to accomplish or what his desires are. And so it's going to be a tricky thing. With the Project 25 thing, 2025 thing, this was a pretty comprehensive, pretty large document that was written. I haven't had a chance to read it. I know some of the basic components of it. A lot of it has to do with cutting taxes, extending tax cuts, obviously some immigration policy things, regulatory reforms, job growth, energy, more energy independence by drilling more oil and getting more coal, these kinds of things. And then obviously efficiency, more in government efficiency. And, to be honest, some of these things are reasonable. I think, there probably is a lot of waste in government that could be removed. Whether or not the private sector is any better or not at doing that is another can of worms. I mean, it's still a very, very large institution, large organization. There's going to be a lot of waste in there. There's going to be a lot of dollars that slip through. I mean, the budgetary process is kind of, with discretionary spending, non-discretionary spending, stuff we can't touch, things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. There's nothing we can do with that. Interest payments, and that's the large bulk of our.
Tino, let me stop you for a second. So related to that, right, to efficiency, what's your theory and your feelings about the whole Doge group led by
Well, I
Elon
mean,
Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy?
I was going to get to that because there's just really not a lot for them to cut. I mean, what are they going to cut? Oh, we get rid of the Department of Education, for example. Well, their budget's like $5 billion. Okay, so
Right.
that's a lot of money, but when you have a $20 trillion budget, like chump change, right? So
Right.
there's not a, they can cut things on the edges if that's their primary focus is to remove quote unquote wasteful spending, and they want to get rid of some departments because they don't like them for whatever reason. There's not a lot of money to be saved. What you've got to tackle is defense spending. That's huge, right? That's 500, 600, $800 billion. That's a large part of the budget. The State Department, I don't know, the State Department is what, 2.5 billion?
But
It's not.
let's stop at the state. Let's stop at the Department of the Defense, right? So
Yeah.
Musk benefits from has a number of contracts with the Defense Department. What's the incentive for him to cut or to steer more his way?
Right. That's the whole, well, I mean,
Mean, it's
yeah,
frightening.
that's the whole moral hazard issue. And Musk is a whole another wild card in this whole thing because he's not anti-immigration. He wants people to
Right.
come in and, which is completely it could come in and fill some of these more engineering types of spots. Maybe he needs more people to build his cars because, if we have a shrinking workforce and now we suddenly don't have people that can work in factory lines. I'm not, that conversant in all of Trump's many or Musk's many different enterprises. But my suspicion is that a lot of what he would prefer is kind of contrary to sort of the rhetoric that's coming out of the Trump administration. The Trumps, I don't know if he's part of the Trump administration or not, to be honest, or, the Trump core, we'll call it that. Yeah, obviously, it's a huge moral hazard issue.
Well, it's an unprecedented set of circumstances. No president that I can recall ever had the richest man in the world, given a semi, authoritative
Right.
position in his administration and
Right.
told carte blanche, go do what you have to do.
Right.
Here, you go
Right.
freelance. Right,
You go free.
freelance.
Right. I mean, go renegade and do what you have to do. And
Right. But I mean, there's not a lot that they can trim. I mean, that's kind of the end game, is that there's only so much. I mean, if they can trim $1 trillion off the budget, no, a trillion. They could trim $250 billion off the budget,
wow.
I would be surprised. I mean, seriously. I mean, it's really,
Well, the
unless they tackle defense. I mean,
right.
because the other departments are just not that big. I mean, again, it's the non-discretionary side, the interest payments on existing debt. And I'll talk about that in a little bit, and I'm sure you guys have questions about that. That Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, these kinds of things that are the bulk of the budget, and those are untouchable. So there's not, you can't shave anything there, short of cutting Social Security, short of cutting Medicare, short of cutting Medicaid, or defaulting on your debt. But once you default on your debt, of course, that's going to start cause a potential spike in interest rates, which could make debt payments even more onerous and soak up more of the existing budget, because people are not going to trust American debt anymore, and that's going to cause interest rates to rise.
Let me put the let's put a foundation here and then talk about some specific things. Let's talk about the current state of the economy. We have 4.2% unemployment. The stock market had a little bit of a year-end downturn that it usually has, but it's doing pretty well. Most people's, retirements are in pretty solid shape. You mentioned the diminished workforce. We don't actually need to create more jobs. We need to get more people to fill the jobs we already have in certain areas, particularly manufacturing and some others. So what's your assessment of where we stand as an economy now? The economy that he's been calling, that Trump's been calling for 4 years, horrible, terrible, the worst economy in American history, blah, 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 all that campaign rhetoric.
To be honest, there's basically two economies, parallel economies going on. There is the economy at 30,000 feet, which looks great. Really low unemployment rates. I mean, with the exception of maybe inflation, that's a little higher than most people would like. Certainly, we'll talk about inflation a little bit later. Unemployment growth has been pretty substantial.
Right.
Incomes have been rising, maybe not quite at the rate of inflation. And so, again, from that sort of macroeconomic 30,000 feet perspective, yeah, everything looks great. But the question then becomes like, what's dragging that economy along? I mean, if you sort of bifurcate the economy into, let's call it the rich economy and the poor economy, a lot of those gains have been in the rich economy with a lot of the even though unemployment's very low, it's a lot of service jobs which have relatively low value added, very low wages. And so you have a lot of people who are just kind of bumbling along paycheck to paycheck, and they live in a completely different economy than do, let's say, the top 20% or the top 40%. And then you have parts of the country which are really suffering, right? I mean, that's a fact. The decline in manufacturing beginning in 1990 to 1995 thereabouts has left kind of hollowed out that economy. And then we also have to be careful about the way some statistics are constructed. So unemployment is 4.2%, but to be included in that 4.2%, you have to actually be looking for work, right? So if you're not
Right.
looking for work, you're not included in that. And so you have I don't want to say a majority, but a large percentage of, relatively large percentage of people who are actually not even looking for work. So they're not included in the unemployment rate.
Right.
So the unemployment rate is kind of quote unquote lower than it actually is, if that makes sense.
Right.
And you also have a lot of people who are underemployed. So, they got PhDs in, I don't know, in philosophy, and they're working at McDonald's or something like that. I mean, so you have
Right.
people with a lot of skills who just are not able to find work that meets their skill set. And so there's a lot of dissatisfaction. So again, you really have to look at our economy on not necessarily on aggregate. The aggregate
Right.
story tells one story, but
So
looking a little bit underneath.
that's the compelling economic story that led to Trump's coming back into office, primarily disgruntled, unhappy, it could be better and whatever. But the reality is, given how large an economy is and how complicated it is, are the programs that have been identified ones that are going to tackle those issues?
Well, from his plan, I haven't seen anything that's going to. I mean, I don't, I don't. I mean, so you want to talk about tariffs. So, one of the sort of goals of tariffs is to protect an industry, to allow it time to grow, become a mature industry, and then once it's a mature industry, that it can compete on its own, and then sort of this is a development strategy. And then once that industry becomes mature, can compete in global markets, then you kind of remove those tariffs. Now we're sort of going the opposite direction. Like we had manufacturing, I'm just going to use manufacturing as an example. We had manufacturing, then a lot of it was sort of when China became much more part of the global economy, a lot of manufacturing shifted over to China because of lower wage costs. And so those kinds of jobs got hollowed out in the United States. And so what these tariffs are intending to do is to sort of rekindle those manufacturing or whatever jobs are being protected by those tariffs. Now, unfortunately, the upshot of that is that a tariff is a tax on imports. The people who pay the taxes on those imports are the importers themselves, right? So that, if you impose a tax on Mexico or Canada or China or wherever, those guys don't pay the taxes. What they end up paying is maybe a smaller demand for their exports because we demand less because the prices are higher. From the last round of Trump tariffs, and we could talk about the Trump tariffs, we could talk about the Bush tariffs, we could talk about the Obama tariffs, and then remember, Biden actually didn't get rid of those tariffs, so we can
Right.
also put Biden in there too, saying he didn't remove those tariffs. But the upshot of those tariffs is higher prices for American consumers. And, about 100%, maybe not 100%, let's say 90, 85 to 90% of all of those tariff costs were pushed onto consumers. So I don't know if you remember when the initial steel tariffs were put into place. I had just moved
Yeah.
here. And a box of nails on Monday cost, $12. That same box of nails on Tuesday cost $35.
Right.
And that was done even though those nails themselves were not actually going through the tariff process. It was the anticipation of the tariff which raised the price of those nails, and suddenly
Right.
building costs went up. So when those building costs go up, then of course housing costs go up. And now it becomes more expensive to have housing. And so now what? Well, if it's more expensive to have housing, then I'm not going to build cheap housing, or I'm not going to build a lot of housing. So now we have a housing crunch. I
Right.
mean, all of these kinds of things ripple through. On top of that, I mean, if you look at a cell phone, I mean, if you look at your iPhone, I mean, it's imported from China. But are you imposing that tariff on the whole iPhone? I mean, 75% of the cost of the iPhone is the R&D, the infrastructure, the software, all that kind of stuff. That's done in the United States. So are you now imposing a tariff on American in, R&D
Right.
and software engineering when you bring that phone back? I mean, I think out of a $100, I'm making these numbers up. Out of a $100 cell phone, like 3 cents is added in China. So are you going to tariff the $100 cell phone or are you going to tariff the 3 cents? Because it's just put together in China.
Right. One of the important things you just mentioned, I think that that our listeners need to understand, is the administration has said, well, we can impose these tariffs and get rid of taxes. But you just said, which those of us that understand it, the government doesn't reap the direct benefit of tariff cuts. It's paid, those tariffs are paid by the recipient of the goods. The money doesn't necessarily go
Right.
into the
And well, when the
government.
government gets those tariff revenues, right? Because the government, it is a tax. And so that's a government tax. So the tariff revenues do accrue to the taxing authority, which is the government. And the question I think you're trying to aim at is because there's going to be tax cuts for the wealthiest or extending these tax cuts from the 2017 Jobs Act, are those tariff revenues that are going to be generated by the government sufficient to cover the tax losses as a result of reduction in taxes, corporate tax rates,
Right.
personal tax rates, all these kinds of things, and the continuation of the previous tax cuts. And the answer is no,
Right.
not even close. And so you can't replace it. I mean, there this
And
is a
part of
very
that could be a strategy to just have less revenue so the government has to shrink because you can't fund
well,
any.
we've heard that before, right? I mean,
Right.
they've tried to do that before, and we're going to go through this again in March because we have to renegotiate, the debt
Right. Debt
ceiling.
ceiling. Yeah.
So this is going to come up again, and I want to talk about debt and my concern about debt and maybe interest rates in a little bit too. But suffice to say, yeah, those tax revenues aren't going to
Right.
cover the tax losses from income tax revenues from particularly from the richest whatever percent, 20, 10%.
Let's talk about debt for a second. Current debt is what, $36 trillion, the national debt?
I'll have to
Something
look it
like
up, but
that.
that something like that.
Is that something we should be alarmed, worried about? We've had national debt my whole life. I can't remember when we didn't have national debt.
Well, we do have national debt, and it has been rising, and it did, it did increase. It's 35.5 trillion dollars right now. It ramped up during the financial crisis, as you might expect. It ramped up during COVID, as you might expect. This is the thing to remember. United States is in a very lucky position insofar as it can, as long as people perceive the United States government as a safe place to invest, we can always lend or we can always borrow money. People will give us money. Now, there comes a point, however, that if we issue a lot of debt in a very short period of time, international financial markets may not be able to absorb that debt, meaning they're going to expect a much higher discount on the price they pay per $1,000 of debt, say. So right now, again, I'm making these numbers up, but they're pretty close. For every, $100 of debt that the United States government issues, people are willing to pay $95, $93 to get, at $100 X periods of time, depending on the maturity time. Now, if we start issuing a lot of debt, and now suddenly the supply of debt goes up, and that increase in supply of debt is not met by an increase in demand for that same debt, that is, people are tapped out, then you will start to see the price of debt fall. Let's just say it goes to $80 per $100, and that's going to start jacking up interest rates. And so, with this tax plan that is in the books, according to what these guys have said, again, I don't know. No one really knows what's going to happen. So there's
Right.
a lot of uncertainty surrounding this. But if this tax plan goes through, and if and by the way, Trump is not increasing government expenditures much beyond what was already in the books already. I mean, he's
Right.
basically followed trend. So the increase in the debt and the deficit over the next foreseeable for the foreseeable future is primarily due to tax cuts. So we need to finance the same amount of spending, but with lower tax revenues, meaning we need to issue more debt. If the appetite for American debt goes down, that's going to start pushing up interest rates because people are going to want a deeper discount on the debt that they're
On
paying.
the right. Let's take a quick ID. Our guest is Robert Sonora. He's the direct professor of finance with the University of Montana School of Business.
So, Tino, the great philosopher Tony Soprano
Yes.
said that even a broken clock is right twice a day. So one of the things I do like about what Trump has said is capping credit card interest rates. No one likes to. I looked the other day. I paid my credit cards every month. I don't have any credit card debt. I looked the other day on some of the cards, it's 32 to 36%.
Yeah.
Isn't that usury? Didn't they used to have ceilings on this sort of stuff?
Well, that's on lending. Now, the way the laws dictate, the difference between credit and lending are a little bit different. But
Yeah.
yeah, it is extremely high. But I think this whole question of the yawning, so when Trump got elected on election day, bond markets basically instantaneously priced higher inflation. Now, I thought that the reason that interest rates ramped up so high was because markets were concerned about just what I was talking about, that the appetite to purchase American
Right.
debt would start to go down and that would start pushing up interest rates. But then I listened to a bond trader interview with a bond trader, and she was saying that what the bond markets were pricing in was inflationary expectations. So because there was going to be, again, it's not a huge increase in spending, but from a government's perspective, but because people have more money in their wallets after taxes, this could cause an increase in spending, which could be inflationary. And so, as a result of this higher debt, I'm sorry, these lower tax revenues and lower tax rates, people are going to start spending more and start driving up inflation. And so, what she was saying is what was happening in the bond markets was just that the bond markets are instantaneously pricing inflation into interest rates, which is why interest rates spiked for a 10-year bond yield, for example, spiked almost immediately, right? There was a stock market boom, and then in bond yields rose dramatically. Now they have since calmed down, and I was sort of I was looking at some data with looking at market-based inflation expectations over the foreseeable future, and it looks like the Fed, the Federal Reserve, the Board of Governors, Federal Reserve, they're targeting inflation rates 2%. And they're really trying to get that 2% inflation back down, get inflation back down to 2%. It's still, kind of high, 2.5%. Core inflation's about 2.7, 2.8%. So they still got some work to do. But I was surprised to see there has been a ramp up in inflation expectations over the short term, but the longer term inflation expectations are going down closer to that 2% target rate right now.
Right.
And again, these are market-based inflation expectations. Again, I don't know if everybody's kind of in a holding pattern, if this is what markets think is going to happen, or if they don't know what's going to happen, or they're just waiting to hear what happens, probably in March. I think we'll have a little bit better idea in March when we hit that debt ceiling thing again. But right now, markets are expecting a Fed funds cut, maybe not this month in January. The Fed's meeting in a week or two, I think. But the next meeting, they're starting to see maybe a 25 basis point cut in the Fed funds rate again. What that's signaling, of course, is that markets believe that inflation is coming down. Now, I personally think there's a few things that could actually move inflation in the opposite direction. The first thing we've already talked about, and that first thing was inflation expectations pushing up borrowing costs. Another one
Right.
was tariffs, which we've also talked about. Again, the economy is restructured since 2017. A lot of manufacturing and what have you that was done abroad has now been cl brought closer to home. Now, we have NAFTA, right? Well, it's not called NAFTA anymore, but the free trade agreement between Canada and the United States and Mexico. And so a lot of firms moved to Mexico, but if or Canada, but if Trump slaps a huge tariff on Mexico or Canada, all that restructuring of their manufacturing is all for naught, really, because then they'll be tariffed again. So maybe they're, some are moving closer to home, or they move some of their manufacturing out of China and moved it to Indonesia or to China or to Malaysia or something like that. But that has a potential for inflation. Again, if these are, there's everything's got a big if right now, if all of these tariffs get through. The third thing that I mentioned too is just that debt. If the appetite for debt goes down, that's going to push up interest rates. That's going to cause deficits and your debts to go up even more, because now it's going to cost more per dollar to borrow. And it could potentially be inflationary, because now people are spending more. So if they're spending more, inflation goes up, and then you know what the Fed's going to do? They're going to start pushing back interest rates up again,
Right, and
which could
all
lead
has
to, which could be recessionary. I
right,
mean,
and
we've
has an
been very
enormous
lucky.
effect.
We have avoided a recession. I mean, if you asked me 2 years ago if we were going to have a recession in the next 18 months, I probably would have said, yeah, probably. Now I'm like, I don't know anymore. We're in a whole brave new world. We've got an inverted yield curve for, I don't know, 24 months in a row or whatever it is. I think there's just a lot of uncertainty, and I don't know what's going to happen. I think eventually, a lot of the inflation that was driven by supply side issues, sort of supply chain issues, these kinds of things could potentially be inflation, are sort of gone now. So I think that inflationary pressure on the supply side is going down. However, another supply side issue we got to think about too is costs of production and costs of construction costs. If we start to push a lot of our workers out,
Yeah, I mean,
because
that's an important issue I think we haven't even touched on, which is, immigration. I mean, we've already alluded to it twice that we are not replacing the workforce with native-born workers. That native-born, the US population in terms of native-born babies is decreasing, not increasing.
I think it's like 0.9 kids per family now. And to replace, you need 2.1, right? So
And
anyway,
I understand the self-serving nature of Doge saying we still like immigration. We just want high-skilled tech workers that work in our companies. But that's not necessarily all the workers that we need in the United States to, to person our businesses and our manufacturers and our agricultural sector. So whether they remove millions of immigrants or just scare people into not wanting to come here, there is an effect on the economy as a result of that,
Yeah, I mean, it starts pushing up wages, and the housing market is obviously the most obvious place that we start looking. There's huge shortage in construction workers, and the average construction worker, is what, 53, something like that. I mean, and no, it's a hard job. It's not easy, and those guys are not getting backfilled by younger workers. I mean, yeah, there is a move to try to get more sort of the 20 somethings and the 30 somethings into construction businesses or heavy manufacturing. But when you have a group of people like that who are aging out and are fixing to retire in the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, that's going to leave a huge hole in construction. And then where are we going to be? We think we have a housing shortage in some parts of the country now. Again, thinking in terms of that two-tiered economy we have here in Western Montana, we have issues with housing because so many people want to move here. Now, Eastern Montana has the opposite problem, right? I mean, with the exception of maybe the shale oil and all that stuff, but that's kind of these are the kind of issues we're going to face, is can we continue to produce stuff if we don't have any workers? Now, obviously, we have automation and what have you is going to start taking over, but that can only take us so far. I mean, certainly a lot of manufacturing and automobile manufacturing, and certainly that's part of the story. It's not just China exporting a lot of manufactured goods. Part of the decline in the manufacturing workforce has been due to automation.
I mean, what we see in Montana in terms of trying to find a handyman, even, or somebody that's going to snow plow your driveway, or to put You know, where Scott and I live, we can't get anybody to give a reasonable price for redoing the roads. The
Right.
prices are so high because not necessarily all the material costs, it's the labor costs. They can't get anybody to do the work. And then
And
around the country.
the waiting list to get anybody to do anything is 18
Yeah,
months, right? I
it's
mean,
exactly. And wherever I go outside of Montana, most of the people that are filling these kinds of blue collar jobs have English as a second language. I mean, basically, it's Spanish speaking, or they're coming from other countries that are filling those jobs. It's not the Scots kids who are graduating Montana State that are going to go out there and take construction jobs or ag
And
jobs
swing a hammer.
and swing a hammer. They're not going to do it. No matter what the salary is.
Right. But
But I love
it's also affecting, sorry, Scott, it's also
No,
affecting ag
please.
too. Like, the healthcare industry is going to start getting affected, particularly with nursing and assistants. These kinds of jobs are also kind of relatively old with the
Yeah.
problem. We certainly saw during COVID. I think that was sort of like, that problem is always kind of like we painted over it, but the wood was still rotting under the paint. And then when
Right.
COVID happened, it kind of stripped the paint off and realized like, oh, two-thirds of our nurses are over the age of 45 or whatever. And so, they're retiring en masse and because of this, and how are we going to backfill even those types of jobs? I mean, it's not just the construction industry, it's so many other industries
Service.
impacted. Yeah, services too.
Tino, I want to ask, I what I love when we speak to you is we learn a lot, and I get the sense that you're looking at big, tranches of data and seeing how kind of what trends are coming, and like you're talking about healthcare, you're talking about construction. What other big data are you looking at? And if you had a crystal ball, how is it going to impact our economy and impact our day-to-day? What are some of those other kind of things that you're seeing, trends that we should be aware of?
It's obviously pretty regional. I have one data point that I've been laser focused on, and it's got several different ways of looking at the same data, and I've been just kind of laser focused on inflation. Because if impacting so much, it's dominating the discussion at the Fed, it's dominating discussion at the voting box, right? And one thing that, so that's been my one data point. And the beauty about economics, in the price, so economists love prices because the price has all the information you need to know. If prices are going up, there's a reason prices are going up, and it's an instantaneous response to whatever that change was. Could it be supply side or demand side? But the price is sort of like that one thing that you point at that says, okay, now I can see what's going on in the bacon market, or now I see what gas prices are doing. I kind of have a sense of what's going on. Obviously, inflation as a whole looks at a basket of goods, and you look at that basket of goods prices are doing. And obviously, it hides some things, like some prices might go up 30% in a month, other prices might go down 30% in a month. But the overall price level, changes in that price level, is really informative. So I like to look at that. I look at bond yields too, because that has a lot of information in it too. It has information about risk. It has information about inflation. It has information about people's perceptions of the value of the dollar at some point in the future. It's got a lot of information in it. I think one thing that has we talk about a lot as economists is we always talk about like targeting inflation. We target, we want inflation at 2%. There was a second group, kind of got some traction about 15, 20 odd years ago, where people started, we shouldn't be targeting inflation because that's just the rate of change of prices. Inflation going down to 2%, prices are still going up, right? They're not coming down. They're just going up at a slower rate. So maybe rather than target inflation, we should start targeting the price level. And certainly we see that over the past 3 to 4 years, when we had the inflationary spike, inflation hit 7, 8%. Prices now permanently 7 or 8% higher than they were, or 14% higher than they were 5 or 6 years ago. They're permanently higher, right? In general. Now, some prices have come down, but in general, prices as a whole are considerably higher than they were in 2019. And that's what's really been eating into people's welfare. Because if wages are not keeping up with that, incomes are not keeping up with that, then their savings are not keeping up with that, right?
Right.
Savings are still like, I don't know, you know, I got a CD at 4%. It's like barely, you know, and I had to get like get a smoking deal. You know, it's not even keeping up with inflation. So savings accounts are shrinking. Now, if you're in the stock market, and you bought Nvidia, for example, you're laughing all the way to the bank, right?
Right.
But you know, for the majority of people, again, a lot of these my little statements of facts are kind of educated, well-educated guesses. But what is the average 50-year-old, you know, having their savings account or in their retirement account is something like less than $100,000. So, you know, that's again that two-tiered system that we're kind of living in is people have seen their savings accounts erode. They've seen their housing, you know, potentially if they're living in Arkansas or whatever, West Virginia, you've seen their housing values shrink. Their jobs are gone. You know, and prices are now 20% higher than they were 5 years ago. And
I
so
want to talk about prices for a second,
that's
Tim.
the issue. That's my thing. That's what I look at.
So, a lot of folks think it's simply corporate greed. You know, the disparity between what CEOs are earning, you know, and the average worker. I saw that Elon Musk paid his Social Security tax within the first 15 minutes of 2025.
Right.
Most of us have to work the whole year to pay. You
Right.
know, we don't. You know, we
I
don't
took him
hit
that long. I would have thought it took like 15
that.
seconds. Right.
Well, he takes a lot in benefits instead of salary. You know, he takes a lot of stock options. You know, our prices. You know, hold. You know, they never come down. It's just like tolls. Tolls on roads never come down. They always go up. They never disappear. Is it just because, you know? And then you look at record profits in many industries. You know, from Walmart to you know to oil and gas and. You know, they had the greatest quarter, I think, in history, the last quarter. You know, how do you control inflation if you have no control over, you know, how corporations are operating in order to make stockholders, you know, happy?
Well, I mean, you know, going back to Musk, you know, Musk does take a lot of his income comes in the form of stocks and what have you.
Right.
And that's a huge moral hazard issue because, you know, then it creates an incentive for corporations to buy back their own stock at a premium, right? Rather
Right.
than, and so they want to boost their CEO's income.
Compensation.
You know, most of us pay income that is earned income, right? That's an income tax. But the way we tax, you know, corporate or any sort of profit taking that you might make on your on investments is taxed at a slightly different rate, right? So their tax rates tend to be lower. So, you know, the famous statement by what's his name about that he pays lower taxes than his secretary, right? Buffett. So those capital gains taxes are different tax rates, and that's where most of the richest people in the world make. They make capital gains. They don't make income. They don't make earned income.
Right.
And so everything's kind of upside down, I think, from that perspective, is that if you have you know, somebody who's making $50,000 a year, you know, they're paying, I remember the exact tax bracket, but on the last, you know, dollar they pay, what we call the marginal tax rate, maybe that tax rate is, say, 36%. Or, you know, but a guy who's making $50 million a year in capital gains tax pays 15% on marginal tax rate on his capital
Right.
gains. And so we, you know, there is a penalty in this way we do things for working, as it turns out, right? You know, if everybody could just buy into the stock market and make capital gains, then everybody would pay a 15% tax rate. But the vast majority of people have earned income, and so they're paying
A higher rate.
progressively higher taxes on their earned income. And so it's actually you're penalized for working in a sense. And then going back to your credit cards, you know, and then you know there was a big thing a few years ago, I know in 2000s, you know, people who were like wanting to live the good life were putting everything on credit cards, right? But their incomes weren't keeping up. And that's why we had so many delinquency rates. And by the way, speaking of delinquencies, Scott, to answer your question, another thing that I kind of keep an eye on is delinquency rates. Credit card delinquency rates is another sort of 50,000, 30,000 foot kind of thing to look at, just to see those have been ticking up. So that's something to keep an eye on. And especially with those 30% interest rates you're talking about on credit cards, which is just bonkers, right? I mean, you can get a paid for
Somebody
lower
wants
interest
to
rates.
buy a new has to buy a new refrigerator for $2,000. They put it on a credit card and they're paying $100 a month. Pretty soon that refrigerator costs them $5,000
Or 10,000,
or
right?
$10,000. It's like
It's
student loans. You never pay back,
like,
right? Because the
Jesus.
interest is four times what the principal was.
Exactly. And I mean, these are obviously, and that's again that two-tiered thing. It's like, if you don't have a credit rating of 800 or whatever, you're at 300, 400, you're at usurious lending rates, because the risk that you face, the risk of default or not paying is so high. And that kind of nicely T-bones back into discussions about if there's an appetite for US debt, and if the United States defaults on that debt, we will see interest rates rise. And so obviously the probability of default starts to rise the more and more we borrow. But as long as the United States is the strongest economy in the world, which it will be for the foreseeable future, and by the foreseeable future, I mean probably 50 to 100 years, people are going to keep giving money to the United States. And so the United States will continue to sort of quote unquote enjoy relatively low interest rates, I think.
Absolutely.
Let's put a pin in it. And we're going to take a quick break. Our guest is Robert Tino Sonara. He is the professor of finance at the business school at the University of Montana. Back after these words. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Tino Sonara.
You know, I think we should change the name of the show to If, because everything is based on if. But for our listeners, tell us what this means for Montana and what optimism do you see as a result of all of this unknown and all of this swirling dervish of activities?
Well, obviously economists tend towards the negative, right? It's the dismal science, right? We always have something bad to say. So the, unemployment goes down 0.5%. Oh, well, that inflation is going to go up. Our inflation is down. Well, unemployment's going to go up. So we're always looking for the negative thing to come out of a positive thing. But I think there are some positives. The United States economy is strong. It's the strongest economy in the world. We will continue as a nation to attract investment. It's still very dynamic. Certainly, we've seen in the aftermath of the election, some movements towards, again, people understanding how important the United States economy is in the world. And so I think going forward, there's going to be some bumps, but I think the economy will continue to grow. There could be, again, we've dodged some recessions. Again, no one said the R word, but I think a lot of people thought we dodged a few, and we did not. I think the Fed's doing a pretty decent job of managing inflation. They're not perfect. They've made some mistakes, but I think they're getting a handle on this thing. The United States economy is so complicated, and we haven't even talked about exchange rates and all these other kinds of things which could be influencing some of these, inflation and employment, et cetera. But suffice to say, I'm not worried, shall we say. I think the big thing I just want to keep an eye on is inflation. And like I said, inflation expectations are close to 2%. And so I think that's a really positive thing that markets seem to think that inflation will remain low. And as long as it does, the Fed will still continue to maybe will continue to lower interest rates. I suspect by the end of this year, the Fed funds rate to be 3 to 3.5%. So it's about 150 basis points below what it is.
Let's leave it there. Tino, come on back next quarter. Okay.
I'd be
Let's have
happy
it.
to. You guys just let me know when let yeah, let's see what happens
Exactly.
in March, and then we'll come in and talk about it. Perfect.
90 days.
Exactly.
All right.
All
Thanks
right,
again,
great. Take care,
Tino.
Tino. You too.
Arnie, I'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.